In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
South Dakota Magazine celebrates 40 years of discovering, sharing, and archiving the stories of our lives. From SDPB, today is Thursday, August 28th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome Bernie Hunhoff to the program. We'll talk about the stories that reveal the character and characters of this place we call home. Speaking of stories, the South Dakota Festival of Books is set for Spearfish. Jennifer Widman is with us. We'll preview the festival, bringing you details of author events, writing workshops, and the literary culture of South Dakota. That's coming a bit later in the hour. SDPB's Ellen Kester brings a preview from In the Moment's literary offerings to come. But first, after the news, NPR's Ari Shapiro is stepping away from the mic. We'll talk with him about 10 years as host of All Things Considered. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. After 10 years of hosting All Things Considered and a 25-year career with NPR, Ari Shapiro will step away at the end of September. His journalism has won national awards, and his memoir is a New York Times bestseller. Shapiro plans to say farewell to NPR with his last show on September 26th. He joined me for a conversation on the critical importance of listener support and the mission of public radio. Ari Shapiro, welcome back to In the Moment here in South Dakota, and we should remind everybody of your North Dakota roots as well.
Absolutely.
You're a Dakota kid.
Lived in Fargo till I was 8. It's where I was born. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. All right. Tell us a little bit. I just need to tell you the context of when we're having this conversation. This team and this show just received our notice of layoffs. So, In the Moment will end at October 31st, and South Dakota Public Broadcasting has cut a third of their staff. In the meantime, thank you. In the meantime, we're really trying to help people understand the support for what remains and what we could possibly build in the future. Tell us a little bit about public radio as a public service in America, especially in places like North Dakota and South Dakota.
Well, it's twofold. It's many more than twofold, but there are two specific things that I would mention. The first is, whether it is extreme weather or other need-to-know information, public radio is there no matter how rural, how remote a part of the state you might live in. Public radio is there when you need it to tell you what you need to know. And as other organizations respond to the demands of their shareholders or their corporate owners, public radio responds to our listeners, our public, our audience. That's what makes it public. And the second thing I would say is that in a landscape where journalism is under assault left and right, there are so few organizations that still have reporters covering the mayor's office, the city council, the governor's office, whatever the case may be. I don't know the specifics of the newspapers or the TV news stations in South Dakota, but I know that all over the country, these organizations have been folding and laying people off. And in many cases, the public radio reporter is the only one doing that work. And that is essential work for a functioning democracy. In order to keep people informed, in order to hold elected officials accountable, you have to have journalists telling the people what's going on. And that's what public radio does. And it can only do it if listeners step up and give.
Tell me a little bit about what makes a public radio story different than a commercial radio story. How would you distinguish them?
I think so much of what we see in other parts of the media is framed as us versus them, kind of tribalistic, who are your enemies and who are your allies. And I've always loved the original 1970 Bill Siemering mission statement for public radio that I've actually kept taped next to my desk because I find it so valuable. There's a line that says, "It will encourage a sense of active, constructive participation rather than apathetic helplessness." There are a lot of different things that public radio does, whether it's telling you about a candidate's position on the issues, or telling you about the state of a war with stories from the other side of the world, or telling you about what's happening in your community. But that value of encouraging a sense of active, constructive participation rather than apathetic helplessness strikes me as one of the most important things that sets apart what public radio does from what others do.
Do you think America has the attention span for some of the long-form work that public radio, especially local public radio, can provide?
Well, from what I hear, people are listening to 5-hour conversations of two dudes sitting in front of microphones. So I think those are some of the most popular podcasts today. So I don't know that attention span is really the issue. I mean, the question is, are people going to step up and support it? Are they going to fund it? We're not lacking listeners. We have just seen the decimation of government funding for public media and the shuttering of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So our crisis is less a crisis of audience and more a crisis of funding, but this is a crisis that our audience can solve. This is a crisis that the public can end by stepping up and pitching in.
Is it an opportunity to reshape and rethink what local public radio can be? And if so, what are some of the questions that we should be asking right now?
Yeah, I think we have to ask ourselves how we reach everyone. And that means across generations, across political ideologies, across occupations, and every category, we need to look and sound like America. And one of the things that's so great about public radio is that when you look at other big media organizations, they might have the vast majority of their staff in New York and Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. And we have hundreds of stations in every state in the country. So that when something is happening in South Dakota, we can talk to people who work for public media, who live in South Dakota, who understand that community and come from that part of the country, that gives us a connection to our audience that others don't have. And so, as the funding shrinks, as layoffs sweep stations across the country, we have to ask how we can do that with fewer resources without sacrificing our commitment to reaching and speaking to and being there for everybody.
Yeah. There was a narrative that public broadcasting, particularly NPR, brought bias to the airwaves. What's your response to that?
I think there's this false narrative that if you are not issuing my talking points, then you're the enemy. And I don't buy into that. I don't believe that. It's true that we are not a mouthpiece for a political party. We're not a mouthpiece for either political party. Anyone listening to 2 hours of Morning Edition or 2 hours of All Things Considered is going to hear something they disagree with. That's part of the point. There are a lot of places you can go that will tell you you're right, that will reaffirm your existing beliefs. Public radio is a place you can go to hear voices you wouldn't hear otherwise and hear perspectives that you disagree with and be exposed to ideas you might not have heard before. If you want to be told that you're right, just let your Facebook algorithm do that for you. Let your TikTok feed give you what it knows you'll like. Public radio is a place to hear things that will surprise you, that will provoke you, that will make you think differently. And that's a fundamental, basic part of the mission. So I understand why people accuse us of bias. And of course, we're humans, we're fallible, we make mistakes, we're not perfect. But I think saying these ideas that I disagree with are on public media, therefore public media is biased, is a misinterpretation of the facts.
Yeah. One final question, and I want to talk about your future. You started as a full-time ATC host about the same time I started as full-time host of In the Moment here in South Dakota.
Oh.
We've both been doing this part of our careers for about 10 years. You wrote a
Yeah.
beautiful thing about being in the waves and in the ocean and then having a moment and realizing that those waves always keep coming. Will you tell us a little bit about what's next for you, but also about, getting out of the water for a little bit and what happens to journalism as you move on to the next thing?
Yeah, I've loved working at NPR for 25 years and being a host of All Things Considered for 10. And there's never a right time to leave, but I've always thought this was the job that I would do for about a decade. And the newsroom continues on. The staff of All Things Considered has only two people who were there before I started. And the people who taught me how to do the job were incredible journalists, and the people who came after me are incredible journalists. So the conveyor belt keeps going, the waves keep crashing. And as for me, while I've been a host of All Things Considered, I've done lots of other things too. You and I spoke about my memoir, The Best Strangers in the World. I went off to Malaysia and hosted a reality TV competition for Netflix called The Mole. I tour a show with the actor Alan Cumming, and I sing with the band Pink Martini, and lots of other things too. And so I want to continue doing journalism as well as all of the other things. And I look forward to having short, medium, and long-term projects and doing things that are in print and audio and video. And even if I don't know right now exactly what those things are going to be, I think wearing many hats will continue to be in my future.
You got to be yourself. That's what we're all.
Who else could you be?
Who else could you be? Ari Shapiro, thank you so much for showing up once again for South Dakota. Thank you for all your work on NPR. And be well.
It's always such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
That's Ari Shapiro, host of All Things Considered. After more than 25 years with NPR, Shapiro's last show is September 26th. After the break, we will celebrate another anniversary. South Dakota Magazine celebrates 40 years in publication. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's take a look back now at the past 40 years, back through four decades of headlines, bylines, stories, photographs, and magazines. That's right, we're going to talk about the 40th anniversary of South Dakota Magazine. Our guest today is Bernie Hunhoff. He's editor, publisher, and founder of the magazine. Here's our conversation. Bernie Hunhoff, welcome back to In the Moment. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
I was delighted that the collector's edition of South Dakota Magazine from the first 40 years arrived in my mailbox before the weekend so I could spend the entire weekend with it. What a beautiful accomplishment.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, I thought it would be an easy summer because it would just be reprinting stories, but it turned out to be a really big task. But I'm so glad you enjoyed it. It's actually been a fun task.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit, about how long, you know, when did you and the team start saying, hey, this is what we want to do for our 40th, and go into the archives? Take us behind the scenes a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, you know, about 20 years ago, we published a book of the first 20 years' favorite stories, and it was really popular. We sold them out. We just didn't get, we thought about maybe doing a book again, and maybe we will try to do one sometime, but we just didn't get around to it. And as the anniversary came closer, we thought, well, we're really good at publishing magazines, if not books. So we thought we would just do it in a magazine. And again, I thought it would be kind of a simple task. I could, you know, do more boating and fishing with the grandkids this summer, but it, and I did, but it was a big task. We've published 240 issues, thousands and thousands of stories, and trying to first choose them and then get them edited into a, you know, a digestible style and length for the readers was a big job, but it was also really educational for especially for some of our younger staffers to just go through that and really learn all about where the magazine's been, what we've been all about, you know, learn more about South Dakota. It's been a good exercise.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what your archives look like. Are they digitized? Are they, or are you flipping through actual magazines trying to find things?
Well, we have a lot of the stories digitized, but we have not digitized all the 40 years of the magazine. We're actually working on that. And Katie writes about that in her publisher's letter, that we really feel a responsibility. These stories are not our stories, they're South Dakota stories, they're your stories, all, you know, everyone's stories. So we really feel an obligation to digitize and preserve those. And weirdly enough, in today's age, digitizing was how you preserve them. I suppose a generation ago, you'd have thought, well, I need to have these on paper to preserve them. But but in this day and age, I think we also need to have them digitized so they're usable and preserved for posterity. So we're working on that right now.
Yeah, Katie did a great job in that editor's letter about that, the sense of, you know, understanding that these stories belong to the people and we need to make sure that they're accessible easily. Is that how you started the magazine, or is that some way that you came into it as you were printing it, where you realized, was there a point where you realized, hey, this isn't just about us building a business and telling stories, this is also about preserving and archiving things for the people of South Dakota now and in the future?
No, when I started the magazine, I just thought it would be a fun way to make a living. And I'd signed a no-compete that I couldn't be in the newspaper business in South Dakota for 10 years because I had a little weekly newspaper that I sold to somebody. And I didn't think I would get back in the newspaper or publishing business. But as we looked around for something else to do, I mean, I just couldn't find anything else around that I really wanted to do. And we kind of came back to publishing, and I'd signed that no-compete, but the no-compete didn't think about newspapers or anything about magazines. So I really got into it for that reason. It's that simple. And I thought, man, if I can just find some, and I know I can find some fun, interesting stories, entertaining stories for readers, I can, they'll write me a check every year and I can stay in South Dakota and it'll be fun. And it was that simple. The readers taught me how important the stories are. Shortly after we started publishing, readers, just the responses to the stories were really overwhelming. It happened very quickly before we had very many readers. Readers talked about how they were homesick if they were living away or they were going to come home or parents were going to start sending the magazine to the kids around the country. I think hoping they would get homesick and come home or for various reasons. Or people would send the magazine to their in-laws so they could learn more about, you know, where they were living today, all sorts of beautiful things like that. And we realized that the stories really have a value. They show us who we are as a people, give us a sense of place. And the readers taught me that. And it you know, we're still in the entertainment business, but it made it a lot more interesting and a lot more worthwhile when we learned that.
Tell me about the first issue. You write, and you write in here that it was not attractive, or you've done some interviews where you say it wasn't pretty to look at. Tell me a little bit about the first issues.
I was pretty much a one-man band then. My wife, Myrna, helped with the business side some, but I was pretty much a one-man band, and you see what a magazine would look like if it was just Bernie's magazine. But as we added people and you know, and more people joined the effort, and a lot of really great writers, you included, writers and photographers from around the state, pitched in, you know, it really started to come together. And I remember one really profound meeting I had with Arnie Larson. He started the National Music Museum in Vermilion, of course. And Arnie was a really great guy. And I interviewed him, I think, the first year of the magazine. And he told me that, you know, people on both coasts and in New York and California both wanted his collection. But he thought, why can't South Dakota have really great things? We can keep it right here in South Dakota and do it. And he said, and then he said, you can do the same with this magazine. He said, you can have the greatest magazine right here in South Dakota. And I was just a young kid then, but it really hit me that darn right we can. That's our challenge, to give South Dakotans one of the country's really great magazines. And I couldn't do it myself. You can look at the first issue and see that, but with everybody's help, you know, I hope we're getting close to that.
Yeah, I love that. You mentioned the writers who have shown up for you, and also along with Katie's column, is a piece called My Dream Job by Roger Holtzman, who really talks about, you know, going through life together, making this magazine, having problems, showing up for each other. There's a real human aspect to this small business.
Yeah, Roger's been with us for 35 of the 40 years.
Wow.
And for about 33 of those years, he's been confined to a wheelchair, and he's been really private about it. He hasn't written much about it. I think most people who read his column and his writings don't know this, but he's lived a really challenging life, and he's done it with a smile on his face and with good cheer. He writes a humor column, right? And he's really a special part of our magazine. He's been ill again here for the last year or two, but now just the last few months he's been coming back in the office, and we really miss him. Wouldn't quite be South Dakota Magazine without Roger.
Yeah, and funny, did you know that humor was important right away, and that it had to be, you know, South Dakota humor?
Yeah. Anyway, one issue we devoted to South Dakota humor and how it's different. And we talked to comedians, both some who'd visited the state and others, other home, you know, homegrown talents. And I think we do have our own sense of humor, and it's really a kind of a cool thing. And I think we have learned that through the years. South Dakotans don't necessarily like to put other people down with their humor so much. They like to make fun of themselves or make fun of their own unique customs and things. And I think we do have a kind of a special kind of humor. And yeah, we recognize it right away. We've always tried to go out of our way to find anything that'll make people chuckle.
Yeah.
One of our first stories was about Red Stanglen, the king of the Norwegian jokes. You know? And we're still repeating his crazy Norwegian jokes.
Other people that are in this collector's edition, a little excerpt from Kathleen Norris. Is it Edward R. Murrow is in here, I think I saw, or am I misremembering that?
No. That's right.
Yeah.
No, and of course, Linda Hasselstrom, and just,
yes.
You know, a lot of, I'm sure we probably missed some of the really great writers too, but
Jerry Wilson,
Yeah, of course.
Comes to mind. Yeah, Linda comes to mind for sure. Of course, Paul Higbee. I mean, this. So when you say, why can't South Dakota have really great things? Anybody who says South Dakota doesn't have really great writers needs to pick up this magazine, not just this issue, but a subscription probably. What kind of writers do we have? How are we growing writers who can do this kind of work?
Yeah, and I think we are. I think we are. I you know, sometimes get asked to speak to high school and especially college classes with writers, with young writers. And whether we have the same numbers that we had a generation ago, I'm not sure, but we've got some really great young people coming along who really do want to explore life in South Dakota, life in the West, and figure out what it's all about. And I'm just really quite encouraged whenever I go to an English class or especially a literature and writing class that they're out there. And it's really, and I tell them, it's really important. It's not just for your own benefit, it's for the benefit of society. All these stories just together show us who we are. They're a quilt of our lives. And every generation has to keep those stories alive and keep them going.
Yeah. Let's talk about John Andrews for a minute when we talk about really great writers that maybe some people don't know because he's so intertwined with the magazine that you might not even notice his byline. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with him and how you've seen him grow as a writer and as a reporter.
Sure. John came in here, I forget the number of years, but I think it was like 15, 16, 17 years ago. And we didn't really have a job opening. We kind of thought we could use somebody for marketing to help with subscriptions. We didn't really have a writer opening. And he came in with a couple little kids. His wife had a teaching job in town here. And he was just obviously loved South Dakota, knew South Dakota. He was a young historian who just, seemed like he had so much to offer. So we created a job for him. I don't know if he ever did very much marketing, but he sure done a lot of good writing for us since then. And I still think of him as a pretty young fellow, but he's, I think, really one of the really Midwest, really good travel writers, great historian. He's just such an asset to us. You know, the people have just always showed up when we needed them. Yeah. And we've just been so blessed. Some on our staff full-time, others part-time through the years, and others, around the state who are freelancers like your contributions, Lori. So, you know, really, I feel more like, and Katie and I both feel more like we're like the directors, hands-off directors, all this good material just comes in and we just try to find a way to put it to its best use.
You like to get into the communities, with a notebook, face-to-face with people. And as I look through I knew this about you, but then you can really see it in the collector's edition here. The people that you meet are the ones that you are drawn to again and again to find out their stories. And those stories and the profiles that you write are profound. And having being someone who wrote like profiles for a long time, it's not an easy thing to do to write a good profile, especially to write lots of them, because you immediately step into like, wow, this sounds like the last one that I wrote. So what makes a good story for Bernie Hunhoff? Am I on the right track there, that it's about the people for you?
No, for sure. And I think I'm a pretty average writer, but I learned very early on, if you've got really good material, just like if you're building a barn, if you got a bunch of junky wood, it's hard to build a good barn. If you got really, really good lumber and everything, you don't have to be quite as good a carpenter. And I just learned, go out and find all the good material you can find. And when you come home, you're not staring at a blank screen so long. The stories just come together a lot better. And it's the fun part for me to just go out and poke around and find really good stories, really good material, and bring it back home. And that's the fun part. My wife says I have a childish curiosity, and she likes all that we do, but the detail that we go into out on the road, I think she sometimes gets frustrated with. I drive down a country road and just admire the way they built the fence in the field, I just love everything about South Dakota and the American West, and I just think we're really lucky to be able to explore it like we do.
Yeah. Is there a corner of the state you haven't been to?
No, we've been everywhere many, many times. I'm sure there's not even a tiny little village I don't think we've been to. I might have forgotten a few of them by now, but we've been to all of them. I joked to the kids, you could drop me anywhere in South Dakota, and I think I'd know exactly about where I am.
Yeah. You know the fence. You could just follow the fence home.
Yeah, that's the way they build their corner posts here.
What is the future of the magazine? What are you thinking as you look at 40 years? Were there surprises that as you put this issue together, where you're like, wow, this is clicking together in a way that even I'm learning something? And then, what does that mean for what's next?
Well, I've come to believe that the magazine is important and is to the state and to the people, and the stories are important, and it's our challenge and our responsibility to figure out how to continue that. Obviously, our industry is changing very rapidly. We're basically kind of what I call road journalism. That we go out and collect stories in a more of a timeless way than some journalists, but the stories are timeless, and they're really important to who we are and what we are, and so we have a big responsibility to keep that going in one fashion or another. I think print's pretty good shape right now. I really do think. I see a lot of our newspaper friends really struggling, and it breaks my heart. I came out of the newspaper business, and newspaper journalism is really important. That day-to-day current events, we're a little bit different kind of journalism. It's important too, and we need to figure out a way, just as our newspaper friends do, we need to figure out a way to keep this alive and working also with today's challenging environment. The internet's actually been kind of a friend to us in some ways. We've been able to reach new readers through the internet, and get them hooked on the paper product. We're always balancing how much we should do digitally and how much we should do in paper. It's a daily conversation here. But overall, stories are timeless, stories are important, and these stories are gonna be maybe even more important 25, 50, 75 years from now than they are today. So we have a responsibility and a challenge to make that work.
Amen. Bernie Hanhoff, thank you so much for the magazine, for the conversations, for all of it. It is great to look at this issue for 40 years and excited for what comes next.
I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much, Lori.
That's Bernie Hanhoff, editor and publisher of South Dakota Magazine. His publication just hit its 40th year in circulation. Up next, we'll get a preview of the South Dakota Festival of Books from the South Dakota Humanities Council. Jennifer Widman joins in the moment in about 90 seconds. You're on Listener Supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Readers and writers from across the region will gather for the 23rd annual South Dakota Festival of Books. The festival takes place this year, September 26th through the 28th, in Spearfish. Jennifer Widman, Humanities Council Center for the Book Director, joined me for a conversation to preview the highlights. Jennifer Widman, director of the Center for the Book in South Dakota. Welcome back to In the Moment. It's been a minute. You've been a little busy.
We've been busy, but thank you, Lori. I know you're busy as well, mm-hmm. and some of what you're busy with is some of the same stuff I'm busy with.
Exactly. I did see the schedule come out and the note that it is 5 weeks, closing in on 4 weeks till the Festival of Books in Spearfish this year. Tell us a little bit about, before we get into the schedule, the change of venues and what are we doing in Spearfish, which is a great community.
Yeah, we've been in Deadwood on our, what we call our West River years, which are the odd years, ever since the first festival in 2003. But we just began to have more challenges getting the venues that we needed in Deadwood because it is absolutely a bustling place with a lot of things going on. There's not really the shoulder season that we used to have in between summer tourism and winter skiing. And so we thought, well, if we're having trouble with venues, let's see what's available nearby in Spearfish. And the community of Spearfish has been really welcoming and excited. Of course, it's a location with a university campus, Black Hill State. They've got a great convention center. They've got wonderful cultural centers like the Matthews Opera House and Arts Center. They have only a little over a year old, I think, little independent bookstore, Henry's Books, which is absolutely delightful. If you haven't been there, you need to go there. So we're learning new things as we go to a new community, but I think it's going to be an equally wonderful place to be at that time of year.
I told the owner of that bookstore to bring journals because I always like, you forget your notebook or you fill up your notebook. I was like, when you're selling books, you should always sell small notebooks and pens and journals. And she said she has some lovely embroidered journals that she would bring. And I'm like, ooh, exciting. So get to the table early.
That's right. That's right.
What a beautiful place to have a festival of books as well. We alluded to it a little bit at the beginning, but for people who are, you know, being reminded now that in April, the Humanities Council lost a lot of funding. Where are you at with funding right now that you want to talk about in relation to the festival itself? In other words, you're still having one.
Yes, we absolutely are. The festival is not going anywhere, at least for this year. It's going to be just as, I think, enlightening and enjoyable and essentially as big as it ever has been. As you said, we had drastic funding cuts in April that came very suddenly, that came in the middle of planning. We had already done quite a bit of work on things. So we decided this is something we want to carry through with to the best of our ability. We have a lot of generous sponsors that help us make the festival happen, and they range from, you know, large partnership gifts like $30,000 from the Larson Family Foundation, down to people who just love our programs who give us $5 or $10 or $25. And it is something that people connect with and they enjoy, and so they want to help us keep it going. And so we knew that for this year, we absolutely could make sure that we had the funds we needed to do the kind of event we wanted to do. We hope that will be the case in future years, but as you know, it's changing day to day. There are two different numbers floating around in the House and Senate about what we may or may not get for funding next year. So we'll wait to see, and then we'll plan accordingly.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about this schedule, because it looks fantastic. Where do you want to begin with the schedule logistics itself for people?
So a lot of people say, well, where are you having it in Spearfish? And the answer is, as we always have in every other community that we've been to, we're having it in multiple places, but we have a headquarters, and that is the Holiday Inn Spearfish Convention Center. That will be the site of our exhibitors hall, our book signings, a lot of author events. But we will also use, like we always do, some of the cultural centers around the community. So our author reception will take place that Thursday evening, that's September 25th, at the Matthews Opera House. Most of our intense writing workshops that are a little bit longer, hour and a half, 2 hours, those will happen at Henry's Books, which will be wonderful. We will use the Grace Ballack Memorial Library, the public library in Spearfish, for events. And then both Friday and Saturday, we'll have 2 to 3 events going on at a time on the Black Hills State University campus in 2 of the halls there. So there will be some back and forth. In Spearfish, you do have to get on the interstate to go from the convention center to either downtown or campus. But truthfully, it's just as fast as getting anywhere in most of the other cities that we've used. And the driving and parking is actually pretty convenient.
Nice. And it's a free festival. People who haven't gone before should know that.
Yeah, we're really emphasizing that, because that is one of the reasons we need to raise funds for it, is because we want to keep it free. We charge for admission to the author reception, where you get food and drinks, and we charge a small amount for those intensive writing workshops that I mentioned. There are 4 of those. Everything else is free. Walk in, sit down, enjoy yourself.
Yeah, I've taken several writing workshops, and if you are interested in growing as a writer, they're such high-end workshops for such a low entrance fee, and it's in person, so you're there with the writer. I have learned so much and grown over the years, especially if you go every year and like find the workshop that fits for you. So for young writers or writers just starting out, and more experienced writers looking for a boost too. But if you don't happen to know about this, it's, I think, one of the best kept secrets of the festival is the writing workshops. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the fact that you're in a small group quite often, you know, it's usually less than 20 people. Sometimes it's even just a handful, but then you get that one-on-one attention, so you can ask the questions that you want to ask, as well as getting tips that you might never have thought of.
Yeah.
So
I've studied with Allison McGee and Linda Hazelstrom and Leanne Rorapaw in workshops. That's, those are rare. Those are rare things. All right. Yeah. Tell us some of the authors that are coming that readers might be excited about.
Well, I think two of them that we've really been talking a lot about are a couple of best-selling novelists. One of them is Alice MacDermott, who is a National Book Award winner for Charming Billy, oh, probably 20 years ago or so, but she has a newer novel called Absolution that deals with women during the Vietnam War and in the years following. Just amazing. She is such a wonderful novelist, but also has some really wonderful craft ideas that she talks about, the kind of the intersection between writing and life and what you can learn about both.
Yeah.
And another best-selling novelist that we've been hoping to get on our roster for several years is Tommy Orange, who made a huge splash around 2019 or 2020 with There, There, now has his second novel, a follow-up connected to that called Wandering Stars. They're both really impactful novels. He's a really unique and powerful writer. We had him booked a couple times during those 2 years that were 2020 and 2021, where the pandemic was still really wreaking havoc with events, and thought, I don't know if we'll have a chance to get him back. And now we've got him back, and you're going to get to talk to
We're going to have a conversation with the audience. I cannot tell you how excited I am
him.
to interview Tommy Orange. I about fell out of my chair when I found out that was a possibility. So thank you, South Dakota Humanities Council.
Oh, yeah.
I want to bring up like writers like Jim Reese and Patrick Hicks and some of the local writers that you might, know from the festival and you see them a lot. Pay attention to the books these two have coming out, because they have two really breakthrough books, I would consider, after following their work and interviewing them for a long time. I would recommend stepping into their sessions as well and seeing what they're up to, because it's pretty exciting stuff. It's fun to watch writers. I mean, obviously they're high-level writers from the beginning, but when they come out with something new and it's in a new way, and you're like, okay, now the rest of the country is going to take real notice of this, and that's what I feel they've got coming up this year. Who else are you excited about that you want to sort of lift up?
I think there are some writers that are doing some really unique work. I mean, we know, for instance, our one book South Dakota is Rebecca Clarin. The
Gosh,
Cost
yes.
of Free Land is a really unique blend of memoir and history and sort of family biography. A writer who's doing something similar to that that I'm really excited to hear from is Mary Annette Pember, who has the book Medicine River, which is a look back at, some of the stories of Indian boarding schools, of which her mother was the survivor of. And she does that same thing where it's a very personal memoir element to it, but she also goes into the, researched and written history of the schools, the oral history of the schools, the personal effects in her family. And I just think weaving together those different kinds of storytelling, she does that in a really wonderful way that's much like the kind of multi-genre approach that Rebecca Clarin takes. And I think that really draws you into what is obviously a very difficult topic.
Yeah. I know Elliot Ackerman is coming. I'll be interviewing him as well. Is there another veteran component? You usually have some kind of veterans writing component, but I'm not sure about this year.
We haven't got the kind of workshops that we usually do for veterans. That's sort of on hold while we look at what our budget can handle and how we can make a bigger impact. But Elliot is going to be available on Friday afternoon, kind of hanging out in the concourse of the Holiday Inn Convention Center and talking to any veterans family members, any veterans caretakers who might want to stop by and just chat with him for a little while. And I hope that people will take advantage of that because he's really making a big impression online with his brand new book Sheepdogs, which is a kind of a thriller novel, but with commentary on our country's involvement in various world conflicts, but kind of not a farce exactly, but there is a little bit of an element of parody in there, of the thriller genre. And yeah, I think having him here is really, really exciting. And he might not be a household name, but he's an incredible writer.
I wonder if the informal gathering, approachable thing is almost preferable to a sit down work. It'd be interesting as you test it out this year to see what people respond to and who shows up. So I
Absolutely.
love how you're always changing things up and figuring out what's next for the festival and what you can do next. Kids stuff, Rapid City or Spearfish, Rapid City School District?
We will do some of each. We have about 10 different children's authors and illustrators coming in. Those include our One Book South Dakota creators, which are, of course, Olympic gold medalist Billy Mills, his co-author Donna Janelle Bowman, and the illustrator SD Nelson. They and some of the other authors will be speaking to schools in Rapid City on Thursday, and then in the Northern Hills on Friday doing some school visits. And we have, you know, some really wonderful national authors, but also some amazing homegrown talent, as we always seem to have. Brittany Richmond is from right there in Rapid City, and she has a wonderful book called Dreams Take Flight, which is the story of South Dakota's first female pilot, and I think the nation's first deaf pilot, if I remember correctly, just really inspiring. And people like Eliza Blue, who has written a story, you know, people know all about her and her music and the other things that she's done, including Wish You Were Here. But she's written her first book for children. It's the story of her two orphan bottle lambs that she and her family raise. So I just think there's a lot going on there that hits different age groups and hopefully can inspire some of these kids to keep telling their stories.
Yeah. Show up for Eliza Blue. That's another example with some of the others, these South Dakota authors that, you know, we show up and support. And they continued with that support to do these really great, new, exciting things. And who doesn't need a book about bottle lambs?
Right? I mean, it's Pearl and Theo. It couldn't be any cuter.
More information, authors, and a schedule of events can be found at sdhumanities.org. Now, in the moment, we'll broadcast live on Thursday in the Rapid City studio at 11 a.m. Mountain Time. That's Thursday, September 26th. Our live show will highlight children's authors Nancy Beau Flood, Brittany Richmond, and Kyla Zhao. That event is free. It's open to the public. You can reserve your seat now at sdpb.ticketbud.com. And then we will also broadcast live from the Festival of Books Friday at 11 a.m. Mountain Time at the Holiday Inn Spearfish Convention Center. Authors Stephanie Anderson, Barbara Mays Bosted, and Sarah Stonich join me in conversation from the stage. Over the coming weeks, we'll bring you quite a few interviews with authors who are coming to the Festival of Books. We're going to close today's show with a taste of what's to come. Gail Blankenaugh is the author of Journey to Freedom, Uncovering the Grayson Sisters' Escape from Nebraska Territory. She spoke with SDPB's Ellen Kester about Nebraska's history of enslavement. Was our southern neighbor a free state or a slave state?
Can you explain the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the precedent it overturned?
Now there's a start to a question. There have been whole books just about the Kansas-Nebraska Act. But as you know, in this book, I do talk about it because it's very relevant to why this particular escape of these two women resonated so strongly nationwide. The Kansas-Nebraska Act, among many other things, overturned the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The Missouri Compromise was supposed to contain slavery below the 3630 parallel. When they annulled that compromise, it opened up the possibility of enslavement being in places like Kansas Territory, Nebraska Territory, Utah Territory, and New Mexico. So now we had vast expanses of geography that were at least open to the possibility of slavery being incorporated as a part of the labor force in these places.
So how did it specifically impact Nebraska? Because when I was in school, I mainly learned about Bleeding Kansas and that side of that history.
Exactly. Another one of the surprises of my research was, although Bleeding Kansas attracted a lot of attention because being south of Nebraska, it was considered more likely to be a slave state. But all eyes were on Nebraska as well. In fact, the newspapers show that Nebraska was constantly in the news for the same reasons. There were people bringing enslaved people in here. And in fact, it was almost done more quietly and with less fanfare and in some ways a little bit more accepted, especially in that southeast corner of the state, which is fairly strategically located. People don't realize that we have this little southeast corner that borders Iowa, but it also borders Missouri, a slave state, and then, of course, to the south, it bordered Kansas Territory. There was even, during this territorial period, a time when part of southeast Nebraska tried to become part of Kansas so that they might be able to keep their slaves.
So if I ask you, was Nebraska a slave state, what would you say to that?
Well, technically, if we say slave state, mm-hmm. no, because we did not become a state until after the Civil War. So we were a state in 1867. However, was Nebraska territory ever, was slavery ever legal here? I would answer yes. And that is one way that the book challenges the old historical narrative. People assumed, because Nebraska was Union and North, and, you know, there was this idea of magic of geography, mm-hmm. Which I also take on in the book. There is no magic of geography. It won't look like plantation slavery in Georgia, but they came from, this family and this family of enslaved people came from Appalachia, southwest Virginia, and the majority of white people there were not slaveholders. They were smallholding farmers, the people who did have enslaved people. And slavery can exist in a lot of different forms and in a lot of different climates. So Nebraska was oddly open to having at least a more domestic, smallholding slavery culture as an accepted part of the labor force.
Okay, so this book centers on the Grayson sisters.
Yes.
How were they enslaved? Like, where did they fit in on this smallholding farm?
Very good question. They were, again, from, this family was from southwest Virginia, a place called Grayson County, and I believe that's probably why they were called the Graysons, mm-hmm. because they were from Grayson County, Virginia. Their enslaver in Nebraska was Stephen Friel Knuckles, who was very wealthy and well-known in Nebraska history. And his father was Ezra Knuckles of Virginia. They were originally born to enslaved women in Virginia, enslaved by Ezra. And they were given and or sold to Stephen Friel Knuckles, the oldest son, to take west with him when he got married and decided to leave Virginia. So that's how Celia and Eliza were chosen out of a fairly large family to accompany this young man and his new bride to come to Northwest Missouri at the beginning, which, of course, being a slave state, it was legal there. And there was at least one other enslaved person in that household, probably Shaq, because he's such a fixture in the household later. And he is either their brother or half-brother. So the three of them accompanied this young couple to help them actually establish a frontier place in Northwest Missouri. And then as time went on, Mr. Knuckles became very interested in the opening of Kansas and Nebraska, seeing huge opportunities to become even wealthier. And as soon as Nebraska territory opened up for settlement, he and his enslaved people were on the ground in the very earliest days of Nebraska history.
That's a snippet of SDPB's Ellen Kester's interview with author Gail Blankenau. Her book is called Journey to Freedom, Uncovering the Grayson Sisters' Escape from Nebraska Territory. Keep your ears perked and listen for the full conversation. We'll bring that to you in late September. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Laura Walsh. Thanks for listening.